Don't mess it up, Bob.
From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, live from the Grand Rapids Art Museum. Today, why Michigan's lucky to have a friend like the Prime Minister of Canada and his big checkbook to pay for the Gordie Howe Bridge.
The entire thing is, I think, a bit of an embarrassment for the state of Michigan, which will be a huge, huge beneficiary of the increased trade.
Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith will be here to tell us about big plans afoot for the Grand River and its watershed, plus why the Grand Rapids Art Museum is in a New York state of mind with a special exhibit in the air.
As you turn around, I mean, really, you can see amazing things happening with the clouds, with the shadows, with airplanes.
And John U. Bacon will be here with us. We'll talk Red Wings and say goodbye to Mike Babcock. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and we are broadcasting today live from the Grand Rapids Art Museum in beautiful Grand Rapids. We would absolutely love if those of you here would share your experience of Stateside Live with us on social media. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can use the hashtag Stateside Live and download the Michigan Radio app and select Share Photos. For today's show, exclusive results from the latest Michigan Radio Public Sector Consultants Michigan's Pulse Poll, taking a look at just who you, the voters, want to take the lead in yet another road funding package, and the answer may surprise you. And then New York Times bestselling author John U. Bacon will be here live from Grand Rapids for a full-court press sports roundup. But first, when Mother Nature gives you a gift like the Grand River, you'd be mighty smart to make the most of it. And Grand Rapids is getting ready to show some real love to the Grand River. Much the way Detroit's working to improve its riverfront, Michigan's second largest city wants to make better use of its river. Michigan Radio's West Michigan reporter Lindsay Smith is here with us now. Hello, Lindsay. It's so good to have you
Welcome
with us.
Welcome to Grand Rapids.
Yes, indeed. Well, before we get into exactly what's in store for the Grand River and the watershed, let's talk a little about what people here want. What are the goals of the Grand River restoration?
It started out with a couple of kayakers that wanted to kayak the Grand River, but if you are familiar with downtown, you can't get past, there's about five dams that are quite dangerous for kayakers and swimmers and any other flotation devices. So they wanted to try to come up with a way to be able to, you know, pie in the sky dream, right? Well, it's turned into a more multifaceted approach to better using the downtown riverfront. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of properties that, you know, don't really have a good forward facing at the river and don't make good use of the waterfront.
See that all over the state.
Yeah, absolutely. So what people really want to do is to be able to access the river better, more places to fish, potentially swim, get their feet muddy, bring kids down to the river, just to be able to have more recreation uses, and then also improve the river quality. So biodiversity, there's a lot of efforts to improve the water condition and quality as it comes down this main, you know, huge part of downtown.
And there's been a lot of public engagement.
Yeah, I talked to a guy today who's really helping running the public engagement. They've talked to more than 3,000 people over the past year or so to really gather a lot of people's opinions about what they want to see, whether it be more parks or more fishing opportunities or amphitheaters, places where your neighborhoods connect better to the downtown, bike paths all the way along the river, like the whole stretch connecting to regional trails. The Frederick Meyer the Frederick Meyer Trails goes all over West Michigan. They would connect that all into it too.
So you talked about like started with pie in the sky.
Right.
What could we do if? So what's shaping up to actually happen?
Well, ideally, what's going to happen, or part of the plan really, is to take out parts of those dams, mm-hmm. Put in giant boulders, you know, in parts to anchor some of these recreation opportunities and make it easier for people to access the river. It's also going to look a lot prettier.
It'll look like what Mother Nature wanted.
What the rapids used to look like before we turned it into a logging manufacturing center, really, back 150 years ago or so. So what we're going to see from here on out, it's still kind of up in the air. The river portion, for sure, you're going to see more natural like I said, boulders and more less walled off and more natural stuff. The land portion of the river project is still kind of up in the air. There's a lot of talk about really making this a master plan that private sector, people that own land on the riverfront, can see this as a master plan and then gear their efforts to redevelop properties to look like what people say in the city they want to see.
And what about like flood management? Because I'm sure that's
an issue.
Got to be an issue.
It is. FEMA is one of the sticking points here. FEMA, after Katrina, really wants everybody to raise their flood walls. Grand Rapids really wants to do the opposite. So that's a sticking point that's going to be, you know, how and where the flood walls can be taken down, how you mitigate that with maybe other places and methods to do that. That's still kind of up in the air. We're waiting on FEMA to kind of hear back on what we can and can't do on that front.
Overall, though, what are the economic and the community benefits that are being touted from doing all this?
Well, studies show that the economic impact could be something like $20 million a year, I think, if all this is completed to attract more tourism, increase property values, you know, increase your natural resource values. Maybe that, I don't know how you put a price on that, but so there is some economic benefits, and certainly tying in the neighborhoods better to the downtown and to the river, quality of life issues. You know, I've lived on the west side and now I live on the east side, and to be able to connect to downtown better is, it could be a huge asset. But the price tag, it's going to cost a lot of money.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
Just the river portion is $30 million estimated. And they are in the process of looking for grants for that. Private donors, there's some interested private donors on that front. But yeah, raising money, getting the permits, getting FEMA to sign out, those are really going to be the hurdles here in the next bit.
Any idea timetable? Like, when might all these wonderful things be done and people really be enjoying the river?
I wish I could say. I can't. Not with a full-on reporter's honest answer. you know, they're in the middle of applying for DEQ, Department of Environmental mm-hmm. Quality, the state permits that they need, hopefully by the end of this year. So we'll be able to see maybe what the state says, and the FEMA decision is supposed to come out also pretty soon. So
really exciting plans, though. It will be great to see all that happen. Lindsay Smith is Michigan Radio's Intrepid West Michigan reporter. Thank you so much, Lindsay.
No problem. Thank you.
And now let's move to a different part of the Grand Rapids Art Museum. With a nod toward Billy Joel, the Grand Rapids Art Museum's in a New York state of mind these days, thanks to a special exhibition that's running for the summer. T.J. Wilcox, In the Air, is a multimedia celebration of the Big Apple's skyline by artist T.J. Wilcox. We say hello now to the director of the Grand Rapids Art Museum, Dana Fries Hansen. So good to be here with you, Dana, and thank you so much for welcoming stateside to this beautiful museum and this very cool exhibit that we're sitting in right now.
We're excited to have you here.
Well, let's have you, if you can, give us a sense of what we're sitting in, because it's a very, very different kind of exhibition.
That's a big, tall order. But imagine walking into a square room into which is inserted a circular screen, 36 feet across, 7 feet high, and there are 10 projectors above our heads projecting onto this circular screen a 360-degree panoramic view of New York City. It was shot all in one day. The film runs start to finish about 30 minutes and scans dawn to dusk. Every minute has something different. It's speeded up in time. There is one clock tower, so you can kind of tell time. If you were imagining the room as a clock, it's kind of at 12 o'clock, I think quite poetically. But as you turn around, I mean, really, you can see amazing things happening with the clouds, with the shadows, with airplanes. And so it's a rich experience, in many ways contemplative.
Very much so. And it's interesting, as you sit and look, you don't see cars, you don't see storefronts because we're up at the rooftop. It looks very different and very ageless. I'm wondering why it was so exciting for you to bring an exhibition all about New York City here to Grand Rapids.
One of the things that interests us in the Grand Rapids Art Museum is the urban experience. We are a downtown museum. We opened in 2007, right at the center. We are adjacent to the wonderful park called Ecliptic, an artwork designed by Maya Lin that forms Rosa Parks Circle. There's a amphitheater, there's fountains, there's, in the wintertime, a skating park. So being part of the hubbub of the downtown, in fact, I live downtown, I love downtown, I'm a kind of urban person. So for the museum, as part of our programming, is to think about what does it mean to be a downtown museum, to be part of a city, and to look at how other cities celebrate architecture, celebrate public participation, and also the change of time. And one of the things that, in talking with TJ, the artist, I realized that what we can offer is his view of the rooftop of his building. That's where it was filmed, what inspired him. But I'm hoping that viewers who come here will walk outside our doors and see Grand Rapids and see other cities afresh and anew.
And at the same time that In the Air is going to be running, you're also, speaking of cooperation and collaboration, you're putting together kind of a, we'll call it a kind of a crowdsourced exhibit about Grand Rapids called On the Ground.
Exactly. So we felt that Grand Rapidians have unique views and unique histories about where they live. And so adjacent to the exhibition is an iterative, interactive project where people can send photographs and stories to our website, artmuseumgr/on the ground, and in a couple days we'll print them out, put them up. And so I encourage people to come back over time and see how that interesting sort of collaborative crowdsourced piece develops over time.
Yeah, it's fun. You've already got some there, but we know that as the summer goes on, that wall's going to be full of images and people's view of their city. Well, TJ Wilcox In the Air runs from now till August 30th, and you can get all the details at artmuseumgr.org. Dana Friis-Hansen, our kind host today and director of GRAM, pleasure to be here with you today. Thank you so much.
And thank you.
Live from the Grand Rapids Art Museum in downtown Grand Rapids, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. And we would absolutely love it if all of you lovely folks here today with us would share your experience of Stateside Live with us on social media. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter and Instagram, and you can use the hashtag Stateside Live, and you can also download the Michigan Radio app and select Share Photos. Now it's time for our weekly check-in with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. He's been cooking up some thoughts on the newly named Gordie Howe International Bridge, the one set to connect Detroit to Windsor, the second bridge. When I spoke with Daniel earlier, we talked about how really lucky Michigan is to have a friend like Canada and its Prime Minister Stephen Harper.
Oh, boy. I mean, he's paying the whole bill. The entire thing is, I think, a bit of an embarrassment for the state of Michigan, which will be a huge, huge beneficiary of the increased trade, of the new span, the construction jobs that will be used to build the span. And yet our legislature gets so tied up in knots by its relationship with Matty Maroon and its allergy to spending, even on a basic infrastructure project, that it takes the Prime Minister of Canada to come in and front the money, and down the road we go.
It makes one ask, do we really have lawmakers, whether state or federal, who are that unable to resist pressure from Matty Maroon, who's, I think, probably the only person who doesn't want the Gordie Howe?
Well, the answer, short answer is pay attention to what they do, not what they say, right? And what they did here was very little. And whether that has to do with Matty Maroon or it has to do with a more conservative legislature that is afraid of being primaried from the right down the road for decisions that they make, remains to be seen. I think you'd have to ask individual legislators. Mm-hmm. But I think the sum total of it is what it is. And it's the Canadians are building this bridge. The other thing I think is very interesting here is even if the legislature were to support something that Matty Maroon was going to do, at the end of the day, we're talking about a sovereign country. And if a sovereign country in Canada decides they don't want to do business with somebody, a private individual, that's their prerogative. And so it's almost like this: if another bridge was going to happen, it was going to have to happen to some extent the way the Canadians wanted it to happen, because they had made their own decision for whatever reason that they weren't going to let a Maroon project make landfall. They think they were pretty clear about that. And as a result, we are where we are, and now we have the Gordie Howe, plans for the Gordie Howe International Bridge.
And it does make both Washington and Lansing look like freeloaders, because it still boggles the mind to me that after all the Canadians put into getting this second bridge going, the Obama administration wouldn't even cough up the, $250 to $300 million to build our own customs plaza. And when you consider the $2 billion to build the bridge, that's kind of pocket change.
Well, exactly. I mean, and this is from an administration that has shown no allergy to spending over the last 6 years. And yet this was a project that they did want to do. And actually, they agreed that they would pay for the operations and the salaries of the customs agents. I was, well, that's good. Can you imagine a foreign country paying the salaries of U.S. customs agents? I mean, there are all sorts of appearance issues, I think, that are raised by that. So, yeah, I don't think, net, I don't think this makes us look very good. Governor Snyder did his best to cut a deal, and to his credit, he was able to cut a deal and essentially go around the legislature in that respect. But nothing was moving very quickly, and I think we're seeing in this legislature a bit of a reticence to move on these kinds of infrastructure issues, and the roads are another example of it.
Well, now, speaking of cutting deals, what do you make of Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan's talks with the Maroons to get a land deal? We know the Maroons have had their eye on Riverside Park since 2007, and this land deal with the city and the bridge companies moving forward. What's going on here?
Well, I think the mayor is being opportunistic. He probably knows what we've been talking about, that this was going to move ahead, that the prime minister was going to do what he was going to do, and he could pledge to support a project. It doesn't take much to pledge to support a project that's likely not to happen.
Because there's not a prayer on earth the Canadians are going to deal away any land on the Windsor side for that proposed second Maroon Bridge.
Well, that's exactly the point, isn't it? And I mean, that certainly seems to be what all the signs are. And again, I think it's important to pay attention to what people are doing as much as what they're saying.
So perhaps Detroit getting out of this would be some money and maybe windows in Michigan Central, which the Maroons have promised to do.
Right, and that's true, but they also are going to get the economic activity comes from this bridge. I mean, this is a very busy crossing, particularly so when you have economic growth time like we're living through right now, and I think it's positive.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Art is supposed to provoke thoughts, provoke questions. Questions like, how can art get us thinking and talking about disability? What does it mean to live with a different body or a different mind? What's it like to live on the outside of normal? These are just a few of the questions coming from the disability community here in Grand Rapids and across the globe. And it's especially notable because 2015 in Grand Rapids has been proclaimed the Year of Arts and Access. Here to talk about using art as a starting point to understand disability are Chris Smith and Mary Lou Dykstra. Mary Lou is with Disability Advocates of Kent County and one of the artists in the DisArt Festival. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's truly a privilege.
And Chris is director of DisArt as well as director of Kendall College of Art and Design's Arts and Access Initiative. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thanks for having us. This is great.
Chris, the DisArt Festival just wrapped up here in Grand Rapids. You're the director. As you put all this together, what is the goal of DisArt?
Yeah, I mean, the goal is quite simple, and that is to change perceptions about disability one piece of artwork at a time. And as we're sitting here in the Grand Rapids Art Museum, we all know the power that art has. But what we might not know is that corner of the world that is labeled disabled, that we have these preconceived notions about disability, what it is. It often enters the conversation or it enters our life as a mystery or as something to be fearful about or something to be scared of. And so what we at DisArt and with a bunch of our allies begin to say is, what's the best way to change people's minds? Mm-hmm. What's the best way to shift the perception so that disability is not something to be feared, but maybe just a simple part of the human condition that many of us share? And so we thought, well, art is probably the best way to do that. And so we put together what became the largest disability arts festival in America. And it was an amazing event on many different levels.
And you are very instrumental in bringing an international disability arts exhibition from England here to Grand Rapids. It's the only U.S. appearance of AIL, which is the Art of the Lived Experiment. Tell us about the scope of ALE.
The Art of the Lived Experiment is probably one of the best contemporary art exhibits of disability arts. This is all top artists from all over the world. And they contacted myself and a colleague, Amanda Kashia, who ended up curating for us here in the U.S., and said, you know, we have this wonderful show. We do it every other year. We've really reached an apex. We want to bring it to the U.S. Where should we bring it? And I said, well, you know, you could go to New York or Chicago or L.A., some of the sort of common places, or you could come to Grand Rapids, where we are full of citizens that know how to do art festivals, thanks to, of course, Art Prize and Laugh Fest and Festival of the Arts, and it won't get swallowed up by a big city. You know, we're just the right size. We have room for you now, Cynthia, and we're glad you're here. But there is an opportunity in Grand Rapids that they couldn't get anywhere else, and they were really excited about that. And so it came here. It's still here all the way through July 30th. Actually, just about 100 yards from here, you can see pieces of that show, and at the UICA, the Urban Institute for Contemporary Art, and Kendall Galleries as well. And so, and all of the artists came over from Liverpool and spent some time with us. It was a great experience.
And they all sounded like the Beatles, right?
Right.
Mary Lou Dykstra, you're not only the program director with Disability Advocates of Kent County, you displayed your own work in DisArt. What would you like to add about why it is so important that these exhibits are here in Grand Rapids, important for the exhibits and for Grand Rapids?
Oh, thank you for that question. I think what we need to do is help change the stigma of people with disabilities of being unable or unable to do things that other people can do. And when you start looking at art, it's something that can cross over all different socioeconomic backgrounds, gender, race, age, because art is something that anyone can really relate to. So by being able to say, I have a disability and I can do art, it makes you not only special because someone says, well, I can't do art. So it really levels the playing field. For Grand Rapids, it's really neat because we are able to say that we have a community of very talented people here in this area, regardless of our ability.
Chris, as you were thinking about getting ALE here from England, did you have to kind of ask yourself, is Grand Rapids in this area absolutely prepared to host this?
No, I knew that we were ready because I've been a disability advocate for a long time in Grand Rapids, and I'm on the board at Disability Advocates of Kent County, and I know the infrastructure of this city. There's two things that make it happen. One is a willingness for advocacy groups to get real changes happening in people with disabilities' lives, and so I knew that was happening, but I also knew that the philanthropic spirit of Grand Rapids is alive and well. And I knew that if I went to the right people and shared this message of reimagining this very important culture. You know, for example, I sat in the office of Mayor George Hartwell, and I had, you know, in 10 minutes, he was on, you know, ready to go, and he declared 2015 the year of arts and access, which is also the 25th anniversary of the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act. So I knew that Grand Rapids was ready, and to be honest, I knew the people were ready, because like I said, Art Prize has created, and really all the festivals we do, has created a space in which culture is enlivened in our streets many, many months out of the year. And so, you know, it's always a risk, of course, to put something like this together. But I was never worried that Grand Rapids couldn't handle it. In fact, they came out in droves, and we have started a cultural conversation about human difference that, you know, is going to continue on.
I'm speaking with two of the leaders of the disability arts community here in Grand Rapids, Chris Smith, who was just speaking as director of DisArt and also director of Kendall College of Art and Design's Arts and Access Initiative, and Mary Lou Dykstra is an artist and program director with the Disability Advocates of Kent County. Mary Lou, you say disability comes in many, many forms. Can you talk to us some about how you came to this work and your personal story?
Thank you very much. I am a person with a disability. I have bipolar type 2 and PTSD, And this has been a very extraordinary experience for me, because being able to come to work for Disability Advocates of Kent County, I shed the personal veil of hiding myself from the world and having a disability. And now I'm speaking very publicly about it, especially because of the stigma of mental illness. Also, being a painter and a mixed media artist, it's an opportunity for me to be able to inform my art because of what goes on in my head. And so this particular experience with DisArt was that opportunity to say, yes, I do beautiful art, and yet at the same time, it's someone once said, well, I see you're in your dark side. Yes, that's where I reside, and that's how I paint, and it's still beautiful.
It must be amazing to see, here you are putting your heart and soul out in your work and then having people come and react and respond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very, very exciting. And I have goosebumps right now just being able to talk about it, because when we start talking about various people's abilities, this is all that it's about, is being able to say, regardless of what you think you can do, you probably can do it. Just give it a shot.
And I think, too, what's really important about what Mary Lou and a lot of artists did during DisArt Festival, you of course know the language of coming out, right, because of gender and sexuality culture and a lot of different narratives there. But, you know, there was a coming out in a lot of people, people who said, thanks to what we did at DisArt, I can be who I am and be upfront about that, and actually start talking about, dare we say, disability pride. I mean, that's really something that, you know, our sister organization in Liverpool, Dada Fest, that helped us get ALE here, you know, they've been pushing that for 30 years. And there's a whole disability rights movement in the United States that's been pushing that. And I think everybody who came to DisArt Festival now knows that history and understands that Grand Rapids is moving towards becoming an inclusive city in which disability becomes part of our energy rather than part of our, burden.
I know the mission statement of DisArt is changing disability perception, one work of art at a time. Are you feeling like it's getting out into the community where it's not just during the show, but it's becoming kind of a constant awareness? I'll start with you, Mary Lou, with that.
Thank you. We are actually going to be embarking as an organization on a conversation that we're currently calling Dis Is. And so what is disability? What does that mean? And so we want to continue to broaden the conversation, and we want to include all disabilities. This is cross-disability. And many people think when you're a person with a disability, it may mean that, like Chris, you use a wheelchair, or you may be someone who is blind or deaf. But we want to be able to say, this is about all people.
Yeah, and I do think that the conversation will continue. There will be events. There's already been many events even after the festival. We keep having conversations in galleries, but we'll be moving into schools very soon and really continue working with folks like at Ferris State University, Kendall and Calvin College, and continuing to bring world-class art in. I mean, that's the thing. When people are invited to an event, it needs to be what we would call a mainstream event. In other words, how do you get everybody down, disabled or not? And then when you get them there, then you sell the message, and then all of a sudden, you know, it has a lot of depth. It's what advertisers call sticky. These events get sticky. So if somebody comes to a DisArt event, chances are they won't be able to sit down at their desk or on their dinner table or anywhere feeling the same way about life and about community and culture. And that's what we're hearing in the feedback that we're getting. So,
last few seconds that we have, plans to get this out around the rest of Michigan, take this kind of movement and go around the state?
Yeah, certainly. We are, you know, we were very committed to Grand Rapids. But now as we move into new models and new festival ideas, there's been a lot of talk about getting disabled artists from all over the state. And there's a lot. And they're, you know, they visited Grand Rapids, they came to the festival, and they're saying, okay, let me get in on this.
We want this.
And we're more than happy to do that. Yeah.
Well, we'll just recap again that the only showing on U.S. soil of Art of a Lived Experiment, ALE, is here in Grand Rapids from now until July 31st, and it's spread among GRAM, also the Kendall College of Art and Design, and the Urban Institute for Contemporary Arts, UICA. Dr. Chris Smith and Mary Lou Dykstra, thank you so much for being with us today on
Thank
State
you,
Science.
Cynthia. Thank you.
Live from the Grand Rapids Art Museum, this is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, we're about 2 weeks past the massive, and I'm not overstating that, massive defeat of Proposal 1 when voters made mincemeat of the road funding plan that was placed on the ballot by the lame duck legislature. So the question of the moment is, what next? Who ought to be taking the lead on the road funding challenge? That was the subject of Michigan's Pulse, the latest poll from Michigan Radio and Public Sector Consultants. And CEO Jeff Williams is here with us today. Jeff, it's always good to have you with us to talk polls.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Tell us a little bit why PSC was interested in polling just post-Proposal 1. What did you want to learn?
Well, we were very curious kind of either way it went. If Proposal 1 had passed a lot of new money into roads, we would have fielded questions about what roads the public wanted to see fixed first. A lot of county roads, interstates, maybe it was a way to fund a little bit of the Gordie Howe Bridge, we'll see. And if Proposal 1 was a massive failure, we were ready with questions on the other side.
And as we know, bitter, bitter failure for the governor in the Vote Yes campaign, 4-1. And so what you asked voters was, what best describes why you, Mr. and Ms. Voter, think the proposal was defeated? So let's talk a little about what some of those answers were.
So I was really curious as a pollster, a lot of tongues wagging, lancing with what the vote meant, you know, yes, moments after the votes were counted. So we actually took a number of those reasons that, you know, people in the know said this is what it meant and asked the voters, what did you mean? And it was really interesting. About 1 in 5 voters said it was because of taxes. Just in general, I don't want to raise taxes, which means 4 in 5 voters picked a different reasons. 1 in 5 voters said it was a failure of leadership. This shouldn't have been kicked to the people, which means 4 in 5 voters picked something else. So the majority answer, about 50%, half, said it was just too darn complicated. It's as simple as that. Too much was packed in there. And in general, in ballot proposals, the more confusing, the higher the odds it went down. I found the greatest factoid is I walked into my office the morning after the poll and was greeted with one of my colleagues who said, you know, you realize that 23% of Americans believe the federal government is hiding UFOs, and 20% said yes to this proposal.
There you go.
That's really kind of, that puts it in perspective of how badly this was received by the Michigan voter.
Back to UFOs for a second.
That's great. That is one we have not heard. I want to talk about the fact that we're hearing the Republicans who are in control of state legislators, senators like a Jack Brandenburg, really pushing the idea that it was about the taxes, that we don't want to raise new taxes. So I guess, taking what you've said, what should lawmakers take away from reading into these polls?
Well, and this is where, again, in polling, they teach you that nothing says the public has to be consistent throughout a survey. Mm-hmm. So in this particular question, I believe that the caucus that says it is about taxes, they're right. For 1 in 5 voters, it is about taxes. But for every voter that says it was about taxes, I've got 2 that say, no, it was too complicated. Mm. This particular poll, we didn't ask the question, would you be willing to pay additional taxes for the roads? Because we don't know the number, we don't know the proposal. So we left that one out to really focus on 3 questions. 1, why do you think it failed? Mm-hmm. 2, who do you think should fix it? And 3, when would you like it fixed?
Well, and we have heard with that in mind, lawmakers saying, all right, we are going to be here all through the summer to get this thing done. And it does seem, looking at the poll, that you know, they're doing what voters want. Nearly 70% of voters say, get it done ASAP, this meaning a permanent road funding solution.
And that was interesting to me. A lot of the talk in Lansing in the aftermath from both Republicans and Democrats was something along the lines of, we've heard what the voters said, we're going to take our time and get it done right, not get it done quickly. And the voters in this poll said, no, you misunderstood us. We would like it done quickly. We actually said as soon as possible as choice 1 and said by the end of summer as choice 2. 70% picked choice 1. So now would be good.
Now would be good. Thank you. What do you take away from what I thought was kind of an interesting finding, that 1 in 4 respondents say they think it is MDOT who should be taking the lead? Do you think it's just because, you know, Michigan Department of Transportation, it just seems to voters, you know, hang responsibility on the Department of Transportation? That sounds good. Or do you really, really think MDOT does need to step in there?
This was a really interesting question. Yeah. We went back and forth on kind of which groups to put in. So we asked MDOT, should MDOT take the lead? Should the legislature take the lead? What about the governor? And we also said, what about the public? Meaning kind of testing, were people mad that the public had to weigh in? Statistically, basically, they all came in at 20%. So there's no real mix. As I kind of read and think about tying all three of these questions together, voters see the roads problem as a roads issue, meaning they want a tight and compact solution. They're looking for anyone to fix it, because in their minds, this is not a big deal, meaning this is not something we need to agonize over in the public opinion for the next 24 months. It's kind of like, you know, just do it, kind of like a kid at the dinner table. It's, you know, blow your nose, pass the salt. Hey, what happened today? You know, just get it done. And they're looking for anyone to get it done. So that really kind of grasp at straws of anyone across the board.
Well, it was surprising, too. I thought fourth on the list was the governor. And I think most people would say, hey, he was the big cheerleader of Prop 1. And he's actually been the biggest cheerleader since he took office, saying we need money for road funding. But there he is, fourth on the list.
Well, and this is where we have to say there's that great margin of error to come into play. So the governor's actually tied for second when you do the statistical margin. Okay. So I'll give the governor some credit here. Yes, these are statistically different answers across the four, but they're all at 20%. Mm-hmm. So out here in the real world, we can say they were tied. The people want somebody to fix it, and again, now.
Anything surprise you in these results? What would anything make you snap your neck with surprise?
So seeing MDOT as one of the four was a snap of the neck surprise, knowing how government works. And I, last time I checked, MDOT couldn't pass a funding bill as an executive agency. But that's okay. You know, the frustration kind of showing. As a pollster, I love to look for differences, because that's where we see kind of what's in here. It was striking to us when we looked at the crosstabs, meaning the groups of people, and were there differences in answers? The basic answer was no. Meaning, why do you think this proposal failed? Only a 5 or 10 point spread between Republicans and Democrats, east side of the state, west side of the state, men and women. Meaning, very consistent answers.
How about that? Unity.
Yeah. Yes. So again, I kind of look at this as we've kind of come to public judgment here, where there's not really multiple minds in the state. There's getting to be one mind that says this is not a complicated problem, no matter what the legislature thinks. Fix it. And I think I'm going to repeat myself, fix it now. That's the loud message.
I think the biggest question I had looking at all these results are, who are the three people who said they don't think the roads need to be fixed?
The public is a wonderful group to survey. I learn something every time we make phone calls. This is a wonderful series that we've done, and we look forward to releasing some more results next week on education issues.
Jeff Williams is the CEO of Public Sector Consultants, joining us to talk about the just-released Michigan Radio and PSC Michigan's Pulse Poll. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you.
A few weeks ago, I called Michigan Radio's sports commentator, John Ubakin, and I said, I know, you are crazy, crazy busy, but please come join us in Grand Rapids. He said yes, and little did we know when John said yes that we would be here with some very, very big sports news to chew over. John Ubakin, welcome. It's great to have you with us here in Grand Rapids.
Thank you, Cindy.
Well, we do have sports now that we know. Mike Babcock is the new coach of the Toronto Maple Leafs, 10 years with Detroit. He called it the greatest job in hockey, but
even the greatest job in hockey can wear thin eventually. This one did. The man coached 909 games in Detroit. I have coached high school hockey. No one has got 909 pregame speeches. They've heard all your stuff after a while, and it's time to go. His first 6 years, they won the division 5 times. They won the Stanley Cup 1 time in there. They were a Stanley Cup finalist, very close, of course, against Pittsburgh. Since then, it's been this side of mediocre, basically. They've not won the division the last 4 years. They take early exits from the playoffs.
Oh,
so
yeah.
In that sense, the thing has kind of run its course. 10 years for a pro coach in any sport is a long run.
Were you surprised that he decided to leave the Red Wings for the struggling Maple Leafs? I mean, Mike Babcock likes to win. He does not like stumbling.
That is true. However, as my father has told me, when you're on the floor, you cannot fall out of bed. Okay. The Toronto Maple Leafs have been on that floor since 1967. Wow. The last time they won the Stanley Cup, there were six teams in the NHL. All right? There are five times that many teams now. The Anaheim Mighty Ducks have won it twice, all right? Since Toronto has won it. The last time Toronto won it, their captain was a guy named Dickie Moore. Dickie is a name that is now currently out of fashion as a first name. All right? This is how long ago this was. They are the Yankees of hockey. They are the most profitable team in the league by far. It is the biggest city in Canada. They've got one, not three as in New York, not two as in L.A., one NHL team. It is a sleeping giant, and it has been for 45 years. He is walking into the best possible situation. A ton of money, rabid fans, and an asleep organization.
Well, 8 years, $50 million. Brendan Shanahan really wanted Babcock, but he probably didn't make a lot of fans amongst his fellow GMs. A way to raise the bar.
Yeah, they'll get over that pretty fast. Look, GMs spend money in all kinds of stupid ways. That's not going to stop them.
All right, let's look at the Wings. As you say, we've seen, you know, that Stanley Cup was in 2008, and it has been a slog, and they have just barely made it into the playoffs, and then we've seen those disappointing first-round exits, and that was getting old, and so are Zetterberg, Cronwall, and Datsyuk. They're all showing some mileage, too, so there's kind of it's a strong team, but it's a fixer-upper in a way, too.
It is, and it's kind of near the end of this ramp. Now, it's amazing for the last 24 years for you hockey fans out there. The Wings have made the playoffs for 24 straight years. Some of the players on the team currently were not yet born when that streak started. That's pretty amazing. They've gone through three or four different cycles during that time. The next cycle is coming up now.
Do you think fans are all that bereft about Babcock going?
It turns out. I did my own little survey.
Yeah.
utterly non-scientific with a completely leading question on Twitter, so go ahead and follow that one. Yeah. Steve Schramm follows it, I can tell you that. I got that. I said, hey, look, are you guys that upset about Babcock leaving, and who is your next best candidate?
All right, so what
and
about being upset?
Not upset at all. One or two might have been out of a batch of 20 or so who responded. This is, again, non-scientific.
Sure.
But then no one's paying me for it either, so you get what you pay for. So they're not upset. They feel like the whole run has run its course. And Jeff Blashill, of course, right here in Grand Rapids, was the only name mentioned as the candidate they want now.
Well, and I watched Ken Holland say that Jeff Blashill is going to be my first interview. He was waiting till 10:15 yesterday morning when he got the word from Mike Babcock that, yep, I'm going to Toronto. And Blashill really, you know, has made his mark, hasn't he, with the Griffins?
Yes, he's from Sault Ste. Marie. That's a plus for we Michiganders, of course. Played at Ferris State, coached Western Michigan, did a great job there. And then, of course, hooked on with the Griffins Red Wings first under Babcock. Mm-hmm. So he knows the system. He knows Joe Louis. He knows the NHL players. A lot of the Wings have had him around as an assistant coach. He's done a great job here in Grand Rapids. He won the AHL title a couple years ago in 2013. And then the next year, he was the coach of the year. So this guy can clearly coach. He's younger. He connects very well with a young bunch. You're about to get a very young Red Wing team. Mm. So this is going to play, I think, very well. This, to me, is a two-foot putt.
I just have to toss out one more hockey note before we move on. I have to give a shout-out to Muskegon's Justin Abdelkader. Did you see what he's going to do this summer? He's going to wrap up his last six college credits and get his college degree. I love that he's doing that.
Gotta love that guy. And now it's time for a shameless plug to my wife in the front row, who will cringe upon, but whenever you see Abdelkader on the TV, I say, you know, back in 2002, Coach John U. Bacon of Ann Arbor here in high school beat Justin Abdelkader, who's a sophomore at Muskegon Mona Shores High. We had him circled and his teammate. I forgot his teammate's name. They're both extremely good, even as sophomores. I said, gentlemen, all I want is those guys on their backside all night. All clean, all straight up, but if I want somebody else to beat us, that's what I want. We contained Abdelkader to merely two goals that night, which is probably a career low for him. We won 6-5, so there's my little claim to fame. Abdelkader, by all accounts, a great teammate, great guy. Friends of mine at Michigan State loved him. And even then, he played a very solid team game. So that's just a good story. He will be, I would predict, one of the next captains of the Red Wings when the next generation comes around very soon.
Mm. All right, I want to switch over now. I want to get your thoughts. When I saw the annual ranking of college football coaches that came out from the Sporting News, and the Big Ten is certainly doing the happy, happy, joy, joy dance. You have three Big Ten coaches in the top six with OSU's Urban Meyer right there, knocking off Nick Saban from the top spot. And to that you say?
Go Big Ten. No one here. outside of Alabama, everyone's happy about that, honestly.
In fact, Saban's number two. In sporting news, as I was reading all the rankings, they think Saban's reign is kind of flattening out, and sooner rather than later, they think he's going to hang it up and show up on ESPN as an analyst.
Well, for the same reason that we've talked about Babcock. How many years can you do this? They're having attendance problems at Alabama because they're winning too many championships. All right, so there's your problem. After a while, I mean, exactly. His wife, Saban's wife, said very unwisely that we don't feel appreciated here in Alabama. Well, exactly. That was not the smartest political move right there. Pointed out that he was, in fact, by far the highest paid employee of the state of Alabama, probably the entire South at that point. So after a while, though, the act runs thin.
Yeah.
And there you are. And D'Antonio's on the rise. Obviously, Urban Meyer at Ohio State.
In fact, we need to say hello, Mark D'Antonio of Michigan State, in third place, up from sixth. You agree with that ranking?
I do, dead on. And here's why. He's not the best recruiter. That's about to change. We'll talk about that. But for flat-out coaching, I don't know if anybody right now in college football is coaching what he has better than Mark D'Antonio is. He's taken 2- and 3-star players, beating my alma mater, Michigan, on a regular basis. That's getting old. And he's also competing on a top-10 level nationwide. So what he's done there has been a truly exceptional job.
Well, here we are in sixth place, coming from absolutely nowhere, not even ranked, is Jim Harbaugh, who hasn't even coached at the college level since 2010 at Stanford, and here he is, number six.
At 0-0, that's pretty good. They really like the spring game.
So. I guess so. I guess they did. You know, we've seen so many tweets and headlines coming from Michigan and Harbaugh, but D'Antonio's been pretty busy recruiting. How do you think he's done?
He's done extraordinarily well. They say you can't quite tell. To read a 17-year-old's mind, of course, is a heck of a thing. Mm. So people can always change their minds. But right now, he seems to be headed for possibly his first top 10 recruiting class, which, as I said earlier, what he's done is taken 2- and 3-star players to top 10. It's going to be easier in some ways taking 4- and 5-stars, but Michigan has gotten 4- and 5-stars and not gotten there. So in some ways, his coaching act may have to change a bit to adjust to what he has coming in. Part of me, believe it or not, even as a fan of the Big Ten, as a fan of D'Antonio's to some degree, feels kind of bad about this because I liked what he was doing. Mm-hmm. What he was doing was great. But you might as well leverage, if you're going to be top 10 that long, you better leverage it for better talent. Great John Wooden quote. Someone asked him who the best coach in college basketball is, and he said the guy with the best players.
And the last few seconds, let's look ahead. Saturday, October 17th, Michigan State at Michigan. What are you most looking forward to?
For the first time in many years, both teams will know how to block and tackle. That'll be good.
John Eubanks, Michigan Radio sports commentator. Thank you so much for joining us live here from the Grand Rapids Art Museum.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors to the broadcast are Ellie Billings, Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and Michigan Radio's social media producer, Kimberly Springer. Zoe Clark is our executive producer. A special thanks to Sia Siegerland and Corey Barton at the Grand Rapids Art Museum. And a special thanks to Michigan Radio Marketing Director, Steve Kropinski. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for being with us.